Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LeDuc in for Joe Donahue. As many of our regular listeners have noted, he has been on the decline as far as cold season the last few days. He finally ultimately lost his voice and asked for help today. So here I am, ready to do my best, filling in, hosting the show with today's panelists, public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois. Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning, good morning. Delighted to be here on National Cookie Day.
Happy
Don't
Cookie
we
Day.
We all want to celebrate that one. Also, National Sock Day. So get those woolly warm socks ready for the cold.
Tis the season
Tis
for
the
both.
Season for both, yeah.
Ulster County Comptroller and former president and CEO of the Community Foundations of the Hudson Valley, March Gallagher, is here. Hi, March. How are you?
Hi, good. So glad to be here. You know, I had to take almost a year off because I was running for office.
Yes, indeed.
So I'm glad to be back. And I was worried during that time that, like, the news would get less crazy and I'd come back and there'd be less to talk about.
If
that hasn't happened.
If
so I'm
only.
Excited to be here.
Not even close. It is wilder and wackier. And those are incredibly euphemistic adjectives for it every day. We're also joined by investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman. Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Sarah. I'm sorry to hear Joe's under the weather.
Of course,
I'm
we
glad
all wish him well.
You're here to cover for him. At the, you know, the winter, I finally winterized my garden, got all my leaves out of the way. My snow tires are on. It doesn't mean I'm going to enjoy it, but I'm ready.
You're ready. That's what you got. I mean, we live here, you know. You have to be prepared for it to be blustery, sometimes snowy. Often cold.
I do have a suggestion. I grew up in Minnesota, and I noticed amongst, I'm the oldest of six, and those of my siblings who had a winter sport or activity that they really loved had a really strong consolation prize. Matter of fact, my brother, who's a real outdoorsman, is the only one who's really stayed. Those of us who didn't develop that just hated winter all the way through. So we started encouraging our son, who some listeners may know, to do some winter activities. Unfortunately, he's become a fiend for hockey, but there we are. He doesn't mind the winter anymore.
But it consumes your life as well.
It consumes a lot of it. It's really, there's an issue because they're going to start hitting next year officially.
Oh.
So that's an issue on the table for us. But I will say, other than that, I've enjoyed it. And I do think, you know, we talk a lot around this table about finding ways to communicate with others that are nonpartisan, where you meet people you wouldn't ordinarily run into. And youth sports is a great way to do that. There are all sorts of folks who I might not otherwise, or they might not otherwise, come in contact with me who I really enjoy spending time with and in a common purpose helping to develop our children. And it's a great example of what can go right in our society.
You know, I do not have a winter sport, but I love winter. And the thing I love about winter is not necessarily getting around to talking to other people. It's sitting home in front of the fire with a book and a cat.
Well, I actually think it's great to get out in the winter. It is so beautiful. Winter walks, snowshoeing, cross-country skiing. You know, there's all sorts of skating. I mean, you know, you get the old people
tons
like me.
Tons of ways to hurt yourself.
No,
I'm
no,
just
no.
kidding.
No,
it's
no.
all it's all of it.
It's really all yes. of it. And I'm really impressed with the New York State Parks. They, you know, they have these winter walks that they do and that kind of thing. And it really is good to get out, get away from the screens, get away from all the noise, and just do and be out and embrace it. I love the winter.
Good.
I really love the winter. And there are no bees in the winter.
There's so no bees in the winter.
I'm particularly
Although
excited.
We do need the
we
bees.
Need bees.
We need
bees. We
need
bees, but
every cycle for the natural ecosystem we need.
For those of us who are allergic, we prefer outdoor activities in the winter where there's not a bee situation.
Sure.
So, yeah. Anyway, embrace the winter.
My snow in the city chops increased when we discovered that our dog absolutely loves running around in the snow. So
yeah,
I'm
yeah,
like,
yeah.
All right. I grew up, you know, playing in the snow in the Adirondacks, got away from it in adulthood, and then got to walk the dog, and he loves it. So it's very, you know,
That's
it's
fun.
Infectious.
Yes, we have a nearby where I am a hill where kids toboggan or people toboggan down the hill. And it was just so fun as I was out shoveling to listen to the, you know, shrieks of glee and stuff. I know it sounds kind of corny, but it was just, you know, really
you don't,
sweet.
Teresa, I want to give you some advice. You don't have to always apologize for being
corny.
Like corny, because you just are. And I think it's cool. And I think if you'll allow me, it's time you just own it and live in it.
I do. It's sweet. I mean, I just loved listening to them from afar.
Yeah.
Just being
screaming their heads off.
Little
so
kids
good.
Screaming their heads off. Sounded like some big kids, too. Kids at heart. It's great. get on a toboggan, go have some fun.
All right. Before we discuss the, you know, the main topics of the day, I did want to mention the music today is featuring Steve Cropper, who was a soulful guitarist and songwriter who helped anchor and celebrate Memphis backing band Booker T and the MGs at Stax Records, and co-wrote the classic songs Green Onions and Sitting on the Dock of the Bay and In the Midnight Hour. He died yesterday. He was 84. He was, like I said, Stax guitarist. He was the house band in the house band Booker T and the MGs, which backed artists like Otis Redding and Wilson Pickett and Sam and Dave and Carla Thomas and countless others. Cropper and guitarist Charlie Freeman formed the Royal Spades, who became eventually the Marquees. We are celebrating, under the advisement, I will point out, of Ray Graff, this incredible musician on his passing. The music today by the Marquees, and then we have some Booker T and the MGs later in the show. RIP and condolences to everybody who enjoyed Steve Cropper, maybe who knew him, and you know, we're grateful as ever for the artistic contributions, and the music will live on. That is Steve Cropper, passed away yesterday at 84. The playlist is posted online at WAMC.org. Again, our panelists here in studio, Teresa Bourgeois, March Gallagher, and Mark Whitman. Let us take a new look at the Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, and the machinations and potential war crimes in the ocean. In a classified briefing for lawmakers, this from the New York Times, scrutinizing the Trump administration's killing of suspected but not confirmed drug smugglers around Latin America, top Republicans in the room appear frustrated. The Pentagon is facing questions about its legal basis for attacking civilian vessels. They sent no lawyers to the October meeting, a move multiple lawmakers in the room considered inexplicable. The Defense Department officials who did attend, these people said, were unable to explain the mission's strategy and scope, even as President Donald Trump openly mused about expanding the campaign to include land targets inside Venezuela. As exasperation among Republicans over the lack of transparency grows, Admiral Frank Bradley is set to meet with lawmakers today, to discuss a September 2nd missile strike on a boat that killed 11 people, including two survivors who died in a follow-up attack as they clung to the wreckage. Admiral Bradley oversaw the mission and is expected to tell the panel of Republicans what he considered the survivors' viable targets, not shipwrecked or defenseless mariners, said a person familiar with the matter. Like others, many spoke on condition of anonymity to describe private or otherwise sensitive conversations. Teresa, you had things you wanted to ask about this situation.
Yeah, well, I hope that some retired military who are listening might write in and share their views about what all of this means to military personnel when Hegseth is excused for what he did with classified information, when there are these very serious questions about lawful orders, when those in the Congress who, like Senator Kelly and Lisa Slotkin and others, who speak out and talk about how you do not follow, you know, you have the right and obligation to question lawful orders, when their lives are threatened by the president, what are the impact on our military, and what's the impact on our allies? You know, the Secretary of Defense, we had this situation, this horrible situation with the National Guard woman being shot and killed by an Afghan person in the country. And the response wasn't just about that person. The President of the United States expanded that to going after everyone from Afghanistan. That includes many people like this alleged shooter who defended our country, who were on the side of our defense. So what does that say to people in other countries? You know, the next time we want to turn to people and to work side by side with our military, who's going to do that? There are really broad and dangerous implications for what's going on in all of these areas. And instead of having a Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense are going into the president and say, don't say those kinds of things about Afghans, given, you know, that they stood side by side with us and we you know, or why the president isn't saying you need to go, Hegseth, because of how you handled classified information. But of course, he can't because of how he mishandled classified information. There are generational impacts to what's going on, and the check against this is Congress and the Republicans in the Congress. We've said this over and over. They really need to step up. And the other thing I'll say is we really need to understand what is at the root of Trump's attack on Venezuela. And you have to ask, does he have personal financial stake in maybe the oil there? What I'm not saying he does. I'm saying it is odd enough and nonsensical enough that and it didn't start recently. Remember, it started with him attacking Venezuela, saying without evidence, saying that the Venezuelans are emptying out their jails and their mental facilities and others and sending the worst of the worst to the United States. He has said that over and over and over again. So clearly he wants Maduro out, but for what purposes? And then finally, he says that this is for drug interdiction and that these folks are sending drugs to our country. But let's look at what the Trump administration has done on the issue of dealing with drug use in this country. Because one of the ways to stop it is stop demand. And they have decimated the budgets for drug treatment and prevention programs throughout the country. And you may know on the county level, because that's where the rubber hits the road, the impacts of that. But they have also reduced the staffing for the Drug Enforcement Administration significantly. You heard Governor Pritzker talk about this in Chicago when he's saying, you want to help us with law enforcement? Give us back the DEA agents who partnered with us. Give us back the FBI agents who partnered with us when we're trying to deal with drugs and guns coming into our cities, right? So this administration has weakened law enforcement. They've defunded law enforcement. They've defunded the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. They've cut funding in CDC for drug treatment research. In all aspects of this, on the law enforcement side and the drug treatment and addiction side, they have weakened our systems, yet they have the audacity to say this is for drug, you know, that we're trying to interdict drugs. What's really going on here, folks?
March?
So, you know, they're blaming Admiral Bradley for the strike, for the double tap strike. And it injures me as a leader who takes responsibility for mistakes made by my people. you have to own your organization, and that's not happening here. I wonder how long Hegseth really will be for this world, because we are seeing significant pushback by the Republicans in Congress. So I wonder if he'll be hung out to dry eventually by the Trump administration. I know that articles of impeachment are being introduced by a representative from Michigan, a Democratic representative from Michigan. We're seeing this work all across Congress, where you're seeing petitions to discharge and you're seeing bipartisan collaboration on those. And I think there is a lot of Republican concern about the way the Venezuela action is going. And I also think, you know, that the attack, the double tap attack hurts their entire argument about the boat strikes, which, you know, the strikes on the boats were to say to take out the tools and vessels driving the drug trade, but this is people. So I just wonder if, you know, as more Republicans coalesce with Democrats to raise concerns, you know, national security concerns and Armed Services Committee concerns, that you might actually see Trump come to the place where he hangs Hegseth out to dry. I feel like it's going to happen.
Mark.
The speculation I've heard is that that will happen, but that there's going to be a necessary waiting period so that Trump doesn't look like he's caving into the liberals too quickly, which if you're a Democratic leader, you hope that you're having adult discussions with your counterparts, the Republicans, and you hope that those discussions include perhaps some trade-off that says, hey, your world calmness. We'll tamp this down for a bit and give you an opening to do something politely. It is amazing to me that we are at all surprised that this is the, if it is the last scene for Hegseth, that this is the last scene, because the opening scenes were of a man who railed against the military being put in straitjackets. He sort of perpetuated this stabbed in the back myth about our conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it was the lawyers who were unnecessarily constraining the war fighters, as he puts it. We saw that he was at best not fully capable of running even smaller organizations. He had no business running the largest and probably most powerful organization ever known to humankind. We put him in this job. We watch him fire lawyers, presumably those who were less pliable. And then we get into this unfortunate situation. If I read between the lines in terms of what I've heard in the press, it sounds like he issued an order that basically said, I want everybody dead. And that in order to accomplish that, the lawyers have reverse engineered a justification that says, well, if there's still a vessel floating around, that physical piece of physical thing floating in the water is a risk to other navigation. So we got to make sure that we take them all out. And if there are people attached to them, so what? Now, that doesn't even pass, you know, a young person watching a World War II movie knows what, when you see that scene, what it means. It is set up by the filmmakers to show you who the really bad, morally bankrupt people are. That's not what the good guys do. That's what the bad guys do. I don't need to read military law, or I don't need a military lawyer to tell me, I don't need fancy French words for in combat or not in the fight to tell me what that is. Beyond that, you've got a guy who was on this public app discussing confidential plans and then lied about it when he was discovered. I have worked with hundreds of young bankers, and I can guarantee you after 6 months in the job, all of them within minutes would have said to me if I had started that chat in a public forum, we got to take this offline. We got to go into the secured. So, and then we're surprised that the movie scene that we're seeing now, the president's responsible, so too is every senator who voted for this guy. But right now, in all deference to those who've lost their lives in the Caribbean, we are playing bathtub bingo battleship on a geopolitical sense. We've got the Strait of Taiwan and other places to worry about. We need to get him out of the job and make America and the world a lot safer.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. We do have some questions already. Autumn writes in and says, I have a question. If Mr. Hegseth has removed or replaced many of the top admirals, generals, commanders, lawyers, and JAG officials, as we've established repeatedly that he has, and if this administration is surrounding itself primarily with loyalists, what assurance do we have that Admiral Bradley will uphold and follow, follow the Constitution above all else?
That's a great point. I want to make the following point. Really good institutions that are ethically and ethically run and set up correctly, and March can, I'm sure, can talk to this better than I, they help people do the wrong thing. Sorry, the right thing. They help people do the right thing. Organizations without ethics or that are poorly organized, unfortunately, often entrap good people into doing the wrong thing. And that's maybe what we are seeing here. And as I said, the stakes in the Caribbean, again, aside from the fact that the loss of life is significant, they are penny stakes compared to the what we as a nation face, the possibility of accidentally starting wars or conflicts. The administration needs to put politics aside and get this right. It's too valuable and too dangerous for all of us.
March.
We have no assurance that that people are going to do the right thing here, but I do think that the U.S. military does have the structure and the guideposts to help people to do the right thing. And I think that's also why you saw those Democratic elected officials who have service experience speaking to you need to do the right thing, right? They put that video out. But, you know, I have no confidence at all, speaking to the listeners, note that we are going to see people do the right thing. And we don't know what Admiral Bradley is going to do. Is he going to come out and actually say, I was directed to do this? We may not have seen all the communications between Hegseth and Bradley. We may not know the full story here. And it'll be very interesting to see what he chooses to do, because you could assume his career is probably over one way or another right now.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. It is expected that the briefing will include extended surveillance video of the operation, including the second strike. There will be more news out of Washington, D.C. today about that, and we anticipate discussing it on the show in the future. We are up against a underwriting break, and we'll return with more from Teresa Bourgeois, March Gallagher, and Mark Whitman after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LeDuc in for Joe Donahue, here with Teresa Bourgeois, Mark Whitman, and March Gallagher. The email address to contribute to the conversation, should you feel inclined to do so, is panel@wamc.org. Please do keep your letters short, to the point, and on topic. Don't include links or attachments if you can get your point across without them. And please don't use obscure abbreviations, and proofread your emails if you have a sec before you send. Please and thank you. Again, the email address, panel@wamc.org. Let us talk about Republicans coming into a row with their speaker. This from the New York Times. Representative Elise Stefanik of New York called Speaker Mike Johnson a habitual liar. Representative Nancy Mace of South Carolina has told people she is so frustrated with the Louisiana Republican and sick of the way he has run the House, particularly how women are treated there, that she is planning to huddle with Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia this week to discuss following her lead and retiring early from Congress. Representative Ana Paulina Luna of Florida has gone around Mr. Johnson in a bid to force a vote he has declined to schedule on a bill to ban members of Congress from stock trading. Less than a year out from midterm elections, in which Republicans' vanishingly small majority is at stake, Mr. Johnson's grasp on his gavel appears weaker than ever as members from all corners of his conference openly complain about his leadership. Some predict that he may not last as the speaker for the rest of his term. The rifts have opened as Republicans preparing to face voters in next year's elections are increasingly worried that they have squandered a year in which their party had total control of government. Many GOP lawmakers are unhappy with the passive role the speaker has played in the redistricting arms race that has spread across the country and upended districts they know how to win, they believe. Even more are angry at his decision to send the House home early for 8 weeks before and during the government shutdown, limiting what they have been able to accomplish. Members in competitive districts are desperate for a vote on extending expiring Affordable Care Act subsidies, which Mr. Johnson is resisting. Ms. Stefanik, to the north of us here in Albany, told the Wall Street Journal in an interview that Mr. Johnson would not have the support to remain speaker if a vote were held tomorrow, adding that disaffection with him among Republicans was that widespread. Teresa.
The line in this New York Times story, this paragraph that really jumped out at me. Well, first of all, yes, Speaker Johnson is a weak speaker. But I'll just read this paragraph. But Ms. Stefanik is not alone among Republican women in feeling aggrieved by Mr. Johnson. Some of them said privately that the speaker had failed to listen to them or engage in direct conversations on major political and policy issues, suggesting that doing so was a cultural challenge for Mr. Johnson, an evangelical Christian who has often voiced firm views about the distinct roles of men that men and women should play in society. So what struck me when I was reading that was, yes, disturbing, but folks, Congresswoman Elise Stefanik has stood shoulder to shoulder, no daylight between her and Donald Trump. That Speaker Johnson's cultural issues upset her, but Donald Trump does not. Let that sink in. They have been working with Tom, all of these folks, given all of the allegations against him for his treatment of women, given how he talks about women, given how ICE folks, by his direction, are treating women, grabbing them off the streets, separating them from their infant children, given the impact on a range of his policies on women. Defunding violence against women programs, defunding research on women's health care, driving women out of positions of leadership across the administration, particularly in the Pentagon, verbally attacking primarily women in the press corps, calling them piggy. That one amazing photo of him with his finger in that reporter's face and his, you know, this angry look on his face. Given, you know, think about what he said about the mother and daughter team in Detroit counting votes and how he literally threatened their lives. They had to move over and over again and go into hiding because of his vitriol against them. None of that bothered Stefanik, right? And this team? Are you serious? Think about his relentless attacks on Fani Willis or incessant attacks on Speaker Pelosi that ultimately led to somebody entering in her home and severely injuring her husband. Think about his behavior against women, and they're okay with that? Elise Stefanik is okay with that. I mean, seriously. And who is Johnson? Why did he hold the house out for 7 weeks and they didn't say anything? Doing Trump's bidding on the Epstein files. That's why. So seriously, folks, Stefanik, you can't. You sure go after Speaker Johnson, but what's the real issue? The real issue is Donald Trump, and you have aligned yourself shoulder to shoulder with him. I'm sorry. It's just stunning. It is just stunning. Yes,
I'm going to start fining you for apologizing.
Okay, I'm sorry, but I just...
There's the first charge.
Yeah, you know, I used to have interns who said, like, you know, all the time, and right. It drove me crazy. And I know sometimes when I'm overtired, I do that too, but I had a quarter jar. I first started with a nickel, but that didn't work. So every time they said, like, you know, I made them put a nickel into a jar. So maybe I'll have to do that myself.
That'll work until they stop making nickels.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, my God. I'm so sad about the whole penny thing.
I figured you might be.
I need the penny. Yeah, bring back the penny.
March.
I have a different take than Teresa. I actually think Elise Stefanik is being incredibly shrewd here. I think that she knows there's been no daylight between her and Trump. She's not trying to make daylight. And now she's going to point guns blazing at Johnson, and every ill and ailment and lack of policy and lack of success in the House is going to be blamed on Johnson, at least from her quarters. She certainly doesn't want Johnson coming to New York and campaigning with her. That gets her nowhere. Trump actually wants her amendment to the Defense Authorization Act because it is in response to having the FBI do investigation into his campaign when he was a candidate, right? This amendment that she's seeking is to have the FBI notify Congress when they are going into an investigation on a candidate. So it is a very pro-Trump sort of approach. She got on that three-way call with Trump and Johnson. She looks like she won, so she looks stronger than Johnson here. And let's not forget, Johnson was, you know, supposedly slow walking her confirmation to be the UN ambassador and complaining to Trump, you're taking too many members of the House. This is going to be a problem for us. And then lo and behold, they decided not to move forward with her position. She may personally blame Johnson for that. So I think there's a lot of animosity there. And I think she comes out looking strong. And I think she knows there's no daylight for her on the campaign trail with Donald Trump. And she actually thinks Trump is going to help her bring out voters in her gubernatorial race. So, you know, I don't know. I have a different take.
No, I totally agree that this is a political move. But what I'm saying is that dog don't hunt. She cannot get away with that because he is Trump. He's Trump's person. I mean, Trump even said that I'm running the House. Right. Yeah. And so they cannot get away with saying, OK, we're not going to go after Trump for his policies. So we're going to go after Johnson for Trump's policies.
Yes.
I totally agree with you, but you shouldn't get away with that. That's hideous. It's ridiculous. You know,
Johnson is losing.
Go after
support.
Trump.
It will be very interesting to see, like, the ban on stock trading, right? There's a position to discharge on that now that has support from both sides of the aisle. They're going to start. Now there's a pathway, a blueprint on how to get things done and work through this Congress. And it's going to hurt Johnson's speakership because stuff is going to start going that he has no control over that they don't necessarily want.
And who's going to become the speaker? Who's going to take that job? Seriously. But no, I don't disagree with what you're saying. She just should not. Stefanik should not be able to get away with that. She owns the Trump agenda, and the public, the voters have voted against it. And the more they vote against it, talk about the power of the vote. That's why these Republicans are finally finding their voice, because the voters have voted and they're hearing it.
Mark.
A couple things. You appoint an evangelical to the Speaker of the House, the position of Speaker of the House, who has publicly said that men and women are fundamentally different. For instance, women are not, I think he said in a recent podcast, women can't compartmentalize as effectively as men.
Okay.
Right. And now we're surprised that he doesn't get along with the women. And this is just like Pete Hegseth. We saw the opening scenes of this movie. This scene should not surprise us. It's a shock to me that it does. I agree with March's analysis. I think it's spot on. And I think the bridge between where Teresa is and where March is the following. If you've ever been to an authoritarian country, there is a cognitive dissonance amongst those who believe in their leader. And there's this constant, well, if only, and I went to Cuba entirely legally, and there was this constant, well, if only Fidel knew about the potholes on my street, it's just the people in the way. Now, I think Lee Stefanik is smarter than that, clearly. Whether or not the section of the electorate in New York State that she wants to continue to court who don't mind or are Trump devotees will draw the distinction that you're drawing, Teresa, which is we all should see her for what she is, which is who is an opportunist who's trying to draw a false distinction between her and Johnson that is a proxy for what should have been a distinction between her and Trump all along. I don't think a lot of the electorates going to catch that nuance, or at least she's betting that if there is room for her in New York State to win the governorship, that's one of the plays she's going to try. The other thing I will say is this whole article, I think, reinforces what I said a couple weeks ago, is that we've already passed peak Trump. Different than saying we're at the end of it or that it's still not going to hurt, stink, be dangerous to this country. But we are clearly past peak Trump for a number of reasons here, including the fact that he's moving into lame duck status pretty quickly. The midterms may accelerate that. There's also a sense in which the public is sort of realizing that he's got far less clothing on than many thought. And they're tired of it. And he lied about what he was going to be able to do for the American people. And they've realized that. They go to the grocery store. And remember, this is a man who didn't say, I'm going to moderate inflation. This is a man who said, I'm going to reverse it. I'm going to bring costs down. Now, that's an unreasonable.
On day one.
Thank you. Right. Right after he solved the war in Ukraine on day one, or even before he entered the White House.
A lot was supposed to happen.
Right.
Late last
and people,
January.
You know, people could care less. I think in general, they're not so concerned and don't hold him responsible whether or not the Ukrainian situation is solved, but they hold him responsible for grocery bills, which he has made worse through his tariffs. We are past peak Trump, and now we're going to see the fallout.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Not surprising, a lot of people have written in about this, and we will discuss some of their letters after this underwriting break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke, here with public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Ulster County Comptroller and former president and CEO of the Community Foundations of the Hudson Valley, March Gallagher, and investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman. The email address to join the conversation this morning, as per usual, is panel@wamc.org. We were discussing before the break numerous attacks on the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, primarily from female representatives of Congress, including Washington County, et cetera's own Elise Stefanik. And Diane writes in and says it's all about the polls. We heard from David, who says Speaker Johnson is the meat between two slices of bread. Trump is one slice, Republican colleagues in Congress the other slice, and Senator Schumer has the Democrats in the House, competitors in the Senate on the other slice. Sometimes politics just gets in the way of the most savvy. We heard from Cheryl, who says, right on, Teresa, you are brilliant and spot on about Stefanik. Kevin says, Stefanik wants to be Speaker. She has realized she won't be governor. What do we think about that theory?
She's not running for her House seat, so how will she be Speaker? However, there is a possibility that they make a change, that they feel like they're sliding into the 26th election cycle with nothing getting done, and that they do make a change of leadership in the House, and at least Stefanik is still there, and maybe, who knows? I don't think it's likely, but it's possible. She cannot, you know, be the Speaker after this current coming year because she will not be in the House. She's not running for her seat.
Yeah,
she's
I think this is all seat. Her trying to get politically well, and I just don't think that this flies. I do think, you know, it requires a public discussion about it, but she has to own the policies of her full-on embrace of the Trump administration. And those policies are going to hurt New York State at all levels, the economy, the changes, the budgets she embraced, the cuts she embraced, the DOGE cuts, all of that. And also, you know, look at January 6th. And think about, there was a hearing yesterday in the Congress about the violence against police officers. And the Republicans were saying Democrats defund the police, Democrats defund the police. But in fact, it's the Republican Trump administration budget that's defunding the police. And look at what they did to the police on January 6th. And there was an officer there testifying at this hearing on the behalf of the Democrats and, you know, reminding people about this massive attack on police officers that then Trump pardons. And where were the Republicans in their protest of that?
March?
I agree that she is going to have to own the Trump administration policies. And I think it's going to get harder and harder to make the argument that these things are good for you. These tariffs are good for you, right? These policies are good for you. I think it's going to become more and more challenging to make that argument. And I think that is going to hurt her in the gubernatorial race.
Think about all of the very important universities throughout New York State. And think about her direct attack on universities, ostensibly, you know, because of anti-Semitism. But what was it really about? And think about the damage that these research cuts, the attack on students and, you know, on funding for colleges. There's a whole host of things. And she owns all of that. And that is bad for the universities. It's bad for developing our future workforce. But it's also bad for the economy because often those universities, just like hospitals and the damage that the Trump administration is doing to our hospitals and healthcare situation, the universities are often economic engines in these communities around New York State and around the country. She owns every bit of that. She can't separate herself as much as she's going to try to.
Mark?
I love political competition when it's done right. And I think New York State would benefit from it. Lee Zeldin in his last campaign, there were some insightful comments that he made, which I think is part of why he did better than anyone would have expected at the outset. And one thing I remember him saying, I think it was in the debate, he said, you know, he said the current governor can't answer the question, people are leaving New York State because, or businesses and people are leaving New York State because. And he enumerated then why and started to talk about some of the policies. I think New York State would benefit from a real focus on that in the next gubernatorial race, even if all it does is force Hochul to make promises about what she'll do and make her more attentive to that issue. Unfortunately, I want to make a plea to the Republicans as if, again, I know better than there's some magical organization. But those who might consider voting for her in a primary, she's ineligible to run, in my mind, because of the January 6th. If you don't believe in democracy when it matters, then don't. If you don't believe it at the national level, then don't run for an election in this state and tell me that you care what the voters think. You had an opportunity to do that and denounce Donald Trump and what he did on January 6th. Not only did you not do that, you aided and abetted him in many ways. So don't come to New York State and say, I want to run for a Democratic election. You're ineligible in my mind. And I would encourage the Republicans. Kathy Hochul is not a bulletproof governor by any stretch of the imagination. The state would benefit from a robust contest for the next term as governor. And the Republicans need to keep looking and find a candidate who isn't burdened by many of the things that I think make, particularly her lack of backbone with regard to January 6th that make her ineligible.
You know, New York outmigration is in part a myth. And I'm trying on my phone to dial up the numbers right now, but
Thank you.
I had looked at it in a challenging conversation with my son because I believed what we're saying here at the table, that people are leaving New York. And my son said, it's not true, Mom. And I was like, yes, it is. And then I went and looked at the data. I was like, well, we had a couple years where it was true, but it's not overall. It's really not that true. So,
well, who can afford to move?
I would just urge listeners to do their own research on this from legitimate sources because it's not as bad as people make it sound.
Okay,
and other people are coming to New York.
You can show me a statistic that says our loss in population maybe isn't that much greater than the nation as a whole, but you can't explain to me. You can't wish away what's happening with respect to Texas now competing with Wall Street for financial firms in other states. There are real threats to the long-term viability of the state, particularly, frankly, down at the point of Manhattan. And also, if you look at even the election of Mondani and the sort of the displeasure in New York City with the arrangement between New York State and New York City, show that this state has a lot of opportunity to improve what's going on in this state and maybe retain and continue to attract more people and businesses. So I even if you could show me a statistic that said people aren't moving to California, Florida, and Texas, I would still tell you the next gubernatorial election should focus on making this state a more conducive place to live and do business.
All right.
I don't disagree with that, but I just want to say I have found it. Census data 23 and 24, we really didn't lose population. So I agree with you, though. I think we're making ourselves a hostile environment to be in. And those people who are leaving, which may be great people with good businesses, are leaving to states that we should see as strong competitors, and we should seek to retain them.
And if you look at the cost of living at this state as compared to other states, and I can tell you firsthand, I mean, I've got experience where Kathy Hochul's slapshot attempt to put new regulations in place in a moment impinges on my household. And so if I'm facing it, you've got to imagine that businesses all over the state are, frankly.
But so you just gave an embrace of Lee Zeldin. And
No. Let me be
Look what he's doing at EPA. I mean, that sort of, you know, little angel, you know, whatever, halo on Lee Zeldin that I thought I heard you say. Look at what he's doing at the EPA to our country. Look what he's doing. He's dismantling the clean energy agenda, which is really, you know, even China, countries around the world understand that's the future. And just a full-on embrace. This is just a little thing, but there's a place called the National Renewable Energy Lab, and they have been doing very good work for a while in terms of leading us to a clean energy economy and bring reshoring manufacturing and such. He's just renamed that because it took away the National Renewable Energy Lab and put a person in charge who's an oil and gas and fracking person, right? And totally dismantling this, you know, the infrastructure. Totally. Look at what they did yesterday on the car emission standards. Look at what they're doing, trying to dismantle efforts moving to electrical. Look at what they're doing on PFAS and weakening the standards on PFAS in our water, and what they're doing on clean energy standards. Lee Zeldin, he gets up and he's, you know, you listen to his confirmation hearing, you think, oh, maybe he's going to be okay. But look what he's actually doing to our country.
Mark, briefly, your position on Lee Zeldin, if you wish to state it affirmatively.
I appreciate
a little halo, embrace, how great he is.
I don't think he said that.
I think he eloquently expressed questions that New York State needs to face during the last campaign that he was in for the governorship of New York. I think that's part of why he did better than anyone would have expected. I didn't vote for him. I wouldn't vote for him again. I just was in my earlier comments. I was focusing on the fact that there are ways this state could and should be a better place to live and to work that need to be faced. And I think that a little heat from a real competitive race for the governorship would help us focus in on and solve those problems. And that's why I'm pleading to Republicans to pick somebody who isn't, by definition, in my book anyway, ineligible to run as in a Democratic system anyway.
Panel at WAMC.org. The panel this morning, Mark Whitman, March Gallagher, Teresa Bourgeois. We will return after news with David Gustina. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LeDuc, in for Joe Donahue, here with public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Ulster County Controller and former president and CEO of the Community Foundations of the Hudson Valley, March Gallagher, and investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman. The music this morning by Steve Cropper, playing with the Marquees and Booker T and the MGs. That song should have been Still the Marquees. And the incredible guitarist, songwriter, and record producer who co-wrote Sittin' on the Dock of the Bay and other incredible hits of American music died yesterday. He was 84. The playlist is posted online at WAMC.org/roundtable. We go now to another topic. Recent statements by President Donald Trump and top administration officials disparaging Minnesota's large Somali community have focused renewed attention on the immigrants from the war-torn East African country and their descendants. This week, Trump said he did not want Somalis in the U.S. because, quote, they contribute nothing. An estimated 260,000 people of Somali descent were living in the U.S. in 2024, according to the census. The largest population is in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, home to about 84,000 residents, most of whom are American citizens. Ohio, Washington, and California also have significant populations. Almost 58% of the Somalis in Minnesota were born in the U.S. The foreign-born Somalis in Minnesota are an overwhelming majority, 87%, are naturalized citizens. Of the foreign-born population, almost half entered the U.S. in 2010 or later, again, according to the Census Bureau. They include many who fled the long civil war in their East African country and were drawn to the state's welcoming social programs. Trump and other administration officials stepped up their criticism after a conservative news outlet, the City Journal, claimed that taxpayer dollars from defrauded government programs have flowed to the militant group Al-Shabaab, an affiliate of Al-Qaeda that controls parts of rural Somalia and often has targeted the capital, Mogadishu. Somali community leaders, as well as allies like Governor Tim Walz and Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey, have pushed back against those who blame the broader Somali community for some recent cases of massive fraud in public programs. Those include what is known as the Feeding Our Future scandal, which federal prosecutors say was the country's largest COVID-19-related fraud case. A lot to discuss here and to catch up on, and we will start with you, Mark.
Yes, Sarah, I appreciate you discussing this. I had sent you a specific article from the Wall Street...
You're a little off mic still.
From the Wall Street Journal.
Thank you.
It's basically a op-ed piece written by Jason Riley. And I read the title, Can Minnesota's Somalis Rise Above the Fraud Scandal? And I almost cried. It still gets me really upset that a publication of the Wall Street Journal... alleged stature could even write that as a headline.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just think how ill-considered that is. Millard Fillmore is a president not well-known, but there's one quote that he allegedly is attributed to him that I like, which is, as no man is responsible for the circumstances of his birth, they afford nothing of which he should be proud or ashamed. So to imply that somehow people who are not involved in a crime need to rise above it because they share something with the convicted criminals, particularly if it's, frankly, a heritage, is the most absurd thing. If the Wall Street Journal wants to print what this gentleman has said, it should do so under its own headline, not a headline that in and of itself is racist, xenophobic, and all sorts of other bad things that I'm sure an academic could enumerate. I do think... There was, but it's funny because I forced myself to read the article. And the article did point out some interesting features, which it did say that there was a specialist on Somali culture, I believe, from McAllister College in Minnesota, who said, look, in Somalia, sort of doing what you can to rip off the government isn't all that uncommon. So these folks may have well have gotten here, the ones who committed the crimes, and decided, hey, there's opportunities here. And the thing that struck me about that is when we talk about assimilation into this country, certainly we talk about complying with the laws, and we also talk about complying with norms over time. And one of the norms I would say is we expect, you know, by the second generation, I would say most people in this country expect immigrants to be fluent in the English language because that's an easier way to move through life here in the country. But I think we got to be really careful much beyond that, because then you get into these terrible racist views of the world where you start to ascribe the behavior of some criminals to everyone who shares a racial heritage. And then you've got the president of our country sitting in the White House as spewing out racism and hate. And why does it matter? It used to matter because the president of the United States, even frankly, if we didn't believe some of them, would never have the audacity to say things like that. How does that affect us? Let me tell you how it affects us. I know a young hockey player who on three of his last four teams has been called special terms, right, by his fellow players, and now has to look at participation in that activity with, as Joe says, with long teeth. There's every friendship he forges now, he's got to look around and say, is this really a true friendship, or is there something behind the scenes here? And for the president of the United States to cultivate that environment, you know, I'm just enumerating one small cost, but it's just horrible. And then to see the Wall Street Journal reinforce it is just further caused me a lot of pain, and I think it's really regrettable. And I think we need to look at all the damage that's being done when people do things like this.
I hope the Wall Street Journal has somebody listening to what Mark is saying, because I firmly agree with his point here. And I want to say, like, 75 people were arrested, okay, in this fraud. There are 76,000 Somalis living in Minnesota. We are talking less than 0.1% of the people involved, okay? So if you're 75 people, 76 out of 76,000 people, you're not talking about this being a common element for all Somali people in Minnesota. And I also want to note, this is kind of old news. 47 of these people were arrested under Biden's Department of Justice. So, like, we're just rehashing this now. I was fascinated. You know, I'm an auditor. So, of course, I was like, ooh, how did this fraud happen? Let me research this. This is so wild. You know, they were basically under COVID claiming that they were giving meals to kids. The main organization was headed up by a white person, not a Somali person. So I thought that was interesting as well. And it is not the large, well, they're saying it's the largest fraud. It's the largest fraud identified with these particular COVID funds. But, you know, there was another case just this year called the 2025 National Healthcare Fraud Takedown, which brought down 324 defendants for $14.6 billion in fraud, including just $10 billion alone on, like, false catheter claims. And we're not going through this list of defendants and looking at their ethnicity, are we? So I found the whole thing to be very disingenuous, the Wall Street Journal article. And the shame of it is, I actually think there was a message there that was really useful, which is Jews and Italians and Chinese and immigrants of all different stripes, when they first came to this country, were tarnished with accusations based on a few bad actors, which every population has, and those groups of immigrants were able to overcome those unfair accusations that were plastered over the entire population. And Somalis are going to be able to do that too. And that should have been the message of the article, not what the message of the article was.
Teresa?
Yes, the public, really, there needs to be a resounding public pushback on this just sheer racist talk. And when Timothy McVeigh was found to have blown up the Murrow Federal Building in Oklahoma City, killing, I can't remember the number exactly, but many children, many, many federal workers, the country didn't turn on white men and say that we had to, you know, go after all white men, right, because they are potentially going to do that, right? It didn't happen. And as I heard, there was a commentator yesterday saying that, you know, when Ted Kaczynski was found to be the Unabomber, we didn't start going after Polish white, you know, men, right, and blame all Polish men and say we had to look at the status of all Polish men in this country. But that's what this is. That's what the attack on the Afghani community, those people who've been brought into this country because they stood side by side with our soldiers and foreign service folks, right? And that's the president's attack on the Somali community, which has been going on now for a very long time. And it's dangerous. It puts them in fear for their lives and their livelihoods. And the only way it's going to stop is if we as a community remember that we in America are a melting pot, and that we don't blame everybody for the acts of some. And you know, we have to, and I'll just say as an aside, and I am not discounting what he did, but this person from Afghanistan, there are many reports about the fact that he had PTSD, that he had deep mental problems, and we have to really understand that. What was at the cause of what he did? It's not excusable, but we have to understand if you know. But all people from Afghanistan in this country should not be paying the price. All people from Somalia in Minnesota are living in fear right now. I can't say that they all are, but they potentially are living in fear because of the way the president of the United States is talking about them and treating them. And the only way this stops is all of us have to do something. We have to speak up in defense of folks.
I remember when some on the left were saying that, you know, they were talking, Elon Musk and Doge were front and center in the news, and people were talking about how they disliked Elon Musk. And maybe we should evaluate, he was a naturalized U.S. citizen, maybe we should evaluate whether or not we should send him back. I thought that was horrible because I think, other than being president of the United States, once you've raised your hand and taken that oath in a good faith effort to become a part of a citizen of this country, that's it. You're equal with the rest of us. So if you break the law, we'll deal with you as we deal with every other citizen, but we're not. The threat of sending someone back specifically is a threat that diminishes the status of everyone who has come to this country and chosen to be a citizen as opposed to those who have obtained it through birthright, and it's despicable. I will say, with respect to the man who allegedly shot the guardsman in D.C., the guardswoman and the guardsman, I agree that, you know, you've got to look at that guy's background. He's in a country that has been war torn by colonialist powers since time started being recording. The U.S. comes in, takes its own shot, co-opts him into a situation where he's arguably working against the interest of some of his countrymen for whatever reason, and potentially under, let's say, situations that are on the edge in terms of ethics and morals. I mean, there is a moral hazard to being part of a U.S. military action, right? And then it all goes badly. He's fully responsible for what he did, but I think you're not fully answering the questions of how do we deal with this in the future if you don't look at that gentleman's background and say to yourself, gee, maybe there's something that could have been done between the time he was taken out of Afghanistan and when he decided to make horrible decisions, which he's now fully responsible for.
When I was young, I used to, we had a family friend, lifelong family friend, who was a prison priest. And so on Sundays, we would go to there and he'd have mass, and we'd go there, and if, say, somebody was supposed to have somebody come to take them out for the day for lunch or whatever, they had a pass, they didn't show up, we would take whatever. But anyway, he often talked about the number of people who were incarcerated who were Vietnam veterans, who, yes, they had committed crimes, but their underlying issue was that they were suffering immensely from PTSD and that they really should not have been there and that they didn't know what else. You know, they end up in prison, incarcerated, just because the system failed them. And so I guess that's why when I see a situation like this, it's not that I don't have deep, deep sympathy for the person who was shot and in one case killed, the other case and terrible. But you have to understand, or at least ask the question, get to the question of what is at the heart of this action? Why did somebody drive cross country and do that? And, you know, what's the mental health situation, and put it in perspective. That's all I'm saying.
We in Ulster County just less than 2 weeks ago had an opening ceremony for our first graduates of our Veterans Court. It's a new court in Ulster County designed to address veterans issues separately. It builds camaraderie among the veterans who are making appearances. Criminal Court Judge Brian Rounds spearheaded the effort, and it took a lot of parties, you know, the DA's office, the Public Defender's Office, Office of Court Administration, probation. I think it's going to be a tremendous success. But what you're suggesting also is that you know, somebody who probably might not be eligible for that court. I don't know, you know, what his status was, but are we giving people the support that they need? And we have a lot of people in this country right now who don't want to give any foreign national any support. That's what I hear when I'm knocking doors.
I think this discussion points out the long-term cost of the moral hazard of being involved in using force on behalf of the United States. And I do think it comes back. It circles back to where we started, which is to have a Defense Department under the leadership of somebody who's, you know, got the moral and managerial incompetence of somebody like Hegseth can have tremendous cost. Just think of – it sounds like, you know, that admiral who was tied up in this was an admirable person if you talk to his compatriots who've spoken out publicly about him. And there are probably dozens of other military officers who were involved in that scene of allegedly, you know, shooting those defenseless, shipwrecked people who will face long-term consequences from their involvement in those actions, which is why, you know, I circle back to how important it is that the right people be in those positions. And certainly, you know, Secretary Hegseth is not the right person.
And remember that that tone was set at the top with President Trump. And on the issue of the Afghans who were brought into this country, you know, in response to what they did to help they and their families, I was pleased to hear an NPR story early this morning where some U.S. soldiers who were there and these some of these folks worked side by side. And I can't remember the name of the organization, but they worked to try to bring Afghans and their families who had assisted the U.S. bring into this country. And they were talking about not only is it essential because of what these folks did for them, but also it's essential because in the future, again, in another country, if we find our military folks in another country who need the same kind of help, who's going to help us if this is how the President of the United States and the Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State and the American people treat those who stood up and helped? And it's dangerous for our soldiers. It's dangerous for our country. Just like not treating classified information properly is dangerous. It makes us a less safe. It's morally wrong, and it makes us a less safe country.
It's scary how fast we can ruin these systems.
And yeah. Just to your court, congratulations on the Veterans Court. I mean, that brings me almost to tears because of what I saw when I was a young person and I heard from our family friend, but also when I was in Boston and when I was in D.C. just volunteering in a homeless shelter, and the number of veterans that were homeless and many of them dealing with addiction, and the roots of that are often because of what they saw in war. And so cheers to you folks for doing that.
Yeah, they took care of us and we need to take care of them.
Exactly.
It was
right.
A very, very moving ceremony, and I think it's going to change a lot of lives for the better.
Deb writes in to panel at WAMC.org and says, if, quote, Somalis have to rise above, ... end quote, then white people have to rise above the criminal in chief. The logical fallacy of that Wall Street Journal piece astounds. We also heard from Rick, who says, hasn't it become abundantly clear that Donald Trump has no information on his own? He's like a drunk racist at the end of the bar reading the New York Post and commenting on it. He's being fed information that infuriates him so that he can go off and motivate his dwindling base into more hatred. And who is feeding him the information? We should all know by now. That is from Rick. Comments?
I think that's true. I'm very concerned about the information that the president receives. A lot of it seems to come from Fox News. He's obviously a television guy and Twitter and Truth Social. And, you know, what information is supplied to the commander in chief is incredibly important, and their bandwidth is limited. So you really want to make sure that it's good information, that it's solid, that it's, you know, correct. And goodness knows what he's getting on a daily basis.
And I think you can see the seams on his costume, frankly. And I think the affordability argument is one where he obviously was told by his people, okay, you've got to start talking, addressing affordability, or we're going to get killed in the midterm. So he says what he read the papers they put in front of him, if you will. And behind the scenes, they said, well, what can we really do about affordability? And it's pretty limited. I mean, he can reverse some of the tariffs, but that's it. So then he gets mad and says, and they basically say, look, you can't reverse inflation. That's probably impossible with any reasonable measures. There's only a limited amount you can do. So then he rants out publicly, this affordability thing, it's a hoax. And what he means that I think in his mind is not that it's truly a hoax, but that, like, what the heck can I do? Now, of course, he ran on that saying that
he applies hoax to a lot of things.
But he said everything that had.
But there are things.
But it, there's not. Look,
there are things you can do.
There are.
The Biden administration was doing. I know.
But he's not. He's not going to reverse. No president is going to take reasonable measures to reverse inflation in the United States without the Fed taking dramatic monetary action, frankly.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. We will continue the program with Teresa Bourgeois, March Gallagher, and Mark Whitman after this news from the BBC. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. The music this morning featuring Steve Cropper, who, in addition to playing with Booker T and the MGs, who we've just heard, and the Marquees, was also the guitarist for the Blues Brothers. So he passed away yesterday at the age of 84. We are thankful for the music and send condolences to all who will miss him. Let us move on to new stories with public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Ulster County Comptroller and former president and CEO of the Community Foundations of the Hudson Valley, March Gallagher, and investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman. The email address, panel@wamc.org. We're going to talk about some FDA and National Institutes of Health stories for the remainder of the show. Again, the email address, panel@wamc.org. This from the New York Times. In the past decade, the National Institutes of Health awarded top scientists $9 billion in competitive grants each year to find cures for diseases and improve public health. Starting in January of this year, the second Trump administration stalled that funding, and by summer, funding lagged by over $2 billion, or 41% below average. But in a surprising turn then, the National Institutes of Health began to spend at a breakneck pace and narrow the gap. But there was a catch. That money went to fewer grants. That means less research was funded in areas such as aging, diabetes, strokes, cancer, and mental health. To spend its budget, the NIH made an unusual number of large lump sum payments for many years of research, instead of its usual policy of paying for research 1 year at a time. As a result of this quiet policy shift, the average payment for competitive grants swelled from $42,000 in the first half of the fiscal year to over $830,000 in the last 2 months. While this might sound like a boon for researchers, it is actually a fundamental shift in how grants are funded, one that means more competition for funding and less money and less time to do the research. To drill down on that a little bit more and explain it before we begin discussing it, in the past, the NIH typically awarded grants in 5 annual installments. Researchers could request 2 more years to spend this money at no cost. Under the new system, the NIH pays upfront for 4 years of work, and researchers can get 1 more year to spend this money, which means they get less money on average and less time to spend it. And because these fully funded grants commit all of their money upfront, it means the agency's annual budget is divided into fewer projects instead of being spread among a large number of scientific bets. The new policy directive came from the White House's Office of Management and Budget, which in the summer instructed the NIH to spend half of its remaining funds to fully fund research grants. In the past, the agency would only do so in special circumstances. The White House has said this would increase NIH budget flexibility by not encumbering its annual budget with payments to previously approved projects. It has said it plans to continue this policy in 2026 while proposing to shrink the agency's budget by $18 billion, with a B, or nearly 40%. The Senate and House rejected the White House's proposed budget cuts, but have not yet agreed on the agency's budget. Teresa.
This is a 5-alarm fire. Serious, serious, serious problem. This is the kind of thing that's happening across all agencies in the government right now in ways that I think it's, very difficult for people to grasp the enormity and the long-term consequences. This is going to have generational consequences on public health, on research, on discovery. You know, research and discovery not only saves a lot of lives, it also drives a lot of economy, our economy in the United States. And, you know, Trump says, you were saying in the last segment that, well, what can you really do for the economy to make it more affordable? Well, one of the things that you can do is invest in discovery and innovation. And you can invest in reducing, you know, the healthcare, you know, illness and such. But it's a lot of numbers, so it's difficult. But this 40 NIH, National Institutes of Health, 40% cut. And so that means cuts 3,500 fewer competitive grants from the NIH this year. In minority health, cut 61% research in minority health. Research in alcohol abuse and alcoholism cut 47%. Research, we're talking about mental health, how critical that is. Mental health research, 43% cut. On aging, 31%. Diabetes, think how costly, how the human cost, the personal cost, and the financial cost of diabetes. They've cut research funding for diabetes by 30%. And it goes, the list goes on and on. And for cancer research, for diabetes research, for aging, neurological disorders. And so there's this across-the-board dismantling. So, you know, we heard some news the other day. You might have heard about nurses and reclassifying how nurses are classified. But it's not just nurses. It's also public health workers. It's also doctors. So that is the pipeline. That's a, you know how hard it is? I don't know. I'm having a hard time finding a general practitioner. You know, so there's so few. You have to wait months to get a doctor who's a specialist. Why? Because there aren't enough in the system, enough of those people in the system. Well, the way you get more in the system is you have a pipeline of people who are studying and preparing to be nurses or public health workers or whatever. And they are dismantling the system for that. They are dismantling the research. And when you dismantle the research, it's not only hurting current researchers, but researchers, established researchers, have young researchers in their labs. And so when you cut their funding, those people have to leave the labs. And so you're not preparing the next generation of researchers. They also, there's a companion story today that should shock everyone, but it's again, it's one of those things where you live in your lives, it's hard to focus on. But at the FDA, Food and Drug Administration, where new medicines are reviewed and approved and come out onto the market, 90% of the top staff, if you look at an org chart, they're gone. They're gone in the last 11 months. The amount of expertise is just breathtaking that our government no longer has. And that's on top of 20,000 plus staff people across the National Institutes of Health and the FDA. This is the fundamental dismantling of what had been in this world, in the world, we're considered one of the models for public health. And so what happens if you're a person who has cancer or has a heart ailment or has a rare disease, and what you have is hope, because you might be in a trial, right? But then the funding for that trial is gone. So where's your hope, right? And this has real-world, real-life impacts for people right now looking for hope of what will save them. But it has long-term impacts. And folks, we've got to wake up to this. We've got to ask, are the Republicans in the House and in the Senate, why are you allowing this to happen? Because it's happening with healthcare. Look at this New York Times story. Look at find the FDA org chart. And if that doesn't shock you into speaking, I mean, this is the dismantling of our research infrastructure.
March.
So depressing. I read news and I read depressing things all the time. But this article about the fewer grants going out for science, both through the NIH and National Science Foundation, was the most depressing thing I've read in weeks. It is a clear example that we don't care about people. And I say we in the broad sense, right? We elected this president. We brought in this administration, and this is what they're doing. This is not an agenda that supports human health or human quality of life. And that is frightening. It was interesting to see there are certain areas that are seeing increases in, say, science fellowships. Those include computer science, physics, and materials research. Okay, good. We're doing something, I guess. But young researchers, you know, and scientists are going to leave the United States. I mean, there are dozens, if not hundreds, of comments on public forums in response to this set of changes and this article alone speaking to that. People are just fleeing the country. They're going elsewhere. They're bringing their genius to other places. And this is the dismantling of the United States, not just of science, but of our entire economy and of our leadership on the global stage. And it's going to last for a very long time. And it's not just hope, Teresa. It's also just real scientific exploration and support for reducing, you know, negative outcomes from these diseases for people who aren't even born yet. So, yes, we have a whole generation of people right now kicked off of these trials. That's terrible. But it's really messing up our science for generations to come, as you said. And it's literally the most depressing thing I've read in weeks.
Mark Whitman.
I don't doubt that we've put a permanent kink in the curve of progress that the United States has helped fund. I harken back to something that Bill Gates said about Elon Musk. He said that his influence on aid cuts will cost the lives of, I think, millions of poor people in Africa, is what Bill Gates said. And it got me to thinking, should we have been spending more all along? I mean, were there more opportunities to save lives? And I always ask my folks, okay, we well understand what's happening today. Let's think ahead. And when you think ahead, the bright spot here might be after the Trump administration is no longer in power. When we try to resurrect some of this, whether it be research funding or aid grants, we do need to take a look sort of from the bottom up and decide how to be as effective as possible. And believe it or not, there are guides around the world, including in China. China's way ahead of us in self-driving cars by leagues. And part of that is because municipalities are fighting to get tests going in their municipalities. They're altering infrastructure to try and accommodate that. So too with medicine, there's a great chance that China will be the other big pharmaceutical power in the world and that they've refined the way to sponsor R&D and develop companies. Now, mind you, they have abuse, fraud, just like we do in the United States. They're aware of it. They're aware that some of it is unavoidable. But I will say, I hope that there will be a reconstruction of the good that this government does on the other side of this. And I do think we should start just like the Project 25 people started years in advance. We should start years in advance of thinking about when we do that reconstruction, how can we do it more effectively? Because maybe there are more people in Africa we can save with an incremental dollar. And maybe there are better ways to spend a few more dollars on research and garner significant fruit for it. I don't know. But hopefully that day comes.
We need to hear from some underwriters. Everybody hold their thoughts. We'll return right to this after this quick break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. Teresa Bourgeois, March Gallagher, and Mark Whitman. We are discussing the NIH's differently and less well-funded science and medicine and research grants. We want to add to the conversation as we continue this latest on vaccines from the FDA and this coverage from the Washington Post. A dozen former leaders of the Food and Drug Administration warned Wednesday that plans for a stricter approach to vaccine approvals risks undermining the nation's ability to fight infectious disease and could threaten the health of vulnerable Americans. In the New England Journal of Medicine, the former FDA commissioners wrote that they were, quote, deeply concerned, unquote, with plans the nation's top vaccine regulator, Vinay Prasad, laid out on Friday in a leaked internal email. They argued that his approach represents a major shift that could delay the arrival of vaccines better matched for evolving viruses, making it potentially prohibitively expensive for new shots to come to market and slow expanded approval of vaccines for more people. Prasad is challenging longstanding vaccine policy, urging the FDA to rethink its framework for annual flu shots, examining whether Americans should receive multiple vaccines at the same time, and requiring larger studies to gain approval for certain jabs. These measures and the unilateral way they are being imposed undermine the public interest, the commissioners wrote in a piece titled "A Threat to Evidence-Based Vaccine Policy and Public Health Security at the FDA." We are seeing coverage on CNN this morning about approvals coming to a vote or discussion, and we continue the conversation with you, March.
Well, I am not surprised to see the work that is happening at the FDA on vaccines. I think that it's part of Kennedy's agenda. They've made it very clear. And they're tapping into concerns of the American people. So, you know, we have a whole system in the United States that really prevents individuals from suing vaccine manufacturers directly. And you have a lot of people who've had negative outcomes. And I think Kennedy and company are capitalizing on that. And the things that they're saying, you know, that they're going to rethink the framework for the annual flu shots, that they're going to examine multiple shots, that they're going to require larger studies, they sound good, right? You're like, oh, yes, larger studies, that sounds good. So I think they're tapping into things that they think will gain support of the American people. But it's continuing of hollowing out of American public health policy, and it is right in line with getting rid of everybody that we've been getting rid of all along, people with expertise who can push back in these agencies. And I think it's going to have generational impacts, just like the other things that we were talking about at National Science Foundation and National Institutes of Health. It didn't depress me as much as NIH and NSF funding, the vaccine thing, because I think I was expecting this exact sort of turn from the Kennedy FDA. Yeah.
But I think we have to pay close attention to that pushback by both former heads of the FDA, both Republican and Democratic administrations.
Including Trump appointees.
Right, right. It was a broad-based, that was a very powerful statement because of the broad range of former FDA leaders who stepped up immediately and said, this is dangerous. And this is part of the Trump administration, RESPO, Vance, you know, the dismissal of expertise, right? So and there's a layering problem here. At the very end of that article, they talk about what's happening at the meeting today with these specific vaccinations, but they also talk about a key person at the FDA who announced this week that he's leaving, and that seems to have reverberated through the community as just a really dangerous sign, because that gets you to that 90% of the expertise, and if you don't have the experts to guide, and then you don't have the people within the FDA to do the work, to do the research, to get at these answers. Sure, RFK can respond and raise questions. It can be researched. But you have to have peer-reviewed research to get to the answers that he's raising. And what he's doing is causing confusion. I want to get to the broader issue of Mark, what you were talking about. I mean, since World War II, the U.S. has developed this triad system of a collaboration between universities, the private sector, and government to have an integrated partnership that drives discovery and innovation, particularly around health issues. Around abroad issues, but around health issues. And it's peer-reviewed. And yes, it can be done better. And a lot of changes have happened with the help of philanthropists who are saying, okay, you know, we'll give money, but you all have to talk to each other. It has to be more collaboration, right? And that has become essentially the envy of the world, right? And that's what, in a matter of 11 months, is being torn apart. And so, yes, we can always do it better. But you know that we know what the basics are. And I was thinking, this is sort of personal side, but my niece and nephew, who I'm very, very proud of, this weekend in Memphis, the St. Jude's Hospital. So St. Jude's Child Cancer, right? Just a very amazing vital resource in our country. both for the children who are saved there and for the research that is done there that's spread across the country and across the world. So there's a major marathon. There's a big race this weekend. It's marathon weekend there, and people are running the marathon and 5K, 10K. And my nephew Eric, he's raised thousands and thousands of dollars, and he's running to raise money. And my niece now is going for a 5K, raising thousands of dollars. So proud of them. Haven't reached their goal yet, but they're getting there. So this is just one example of all sorts of philanthropy around the country around diseases, whether it's Alzheimer's or diabetes. There's all these kinds of walks and efforts. And those are crucial to driving an answer and driving supports. But they are never going to be enough. And if the Project 2025 people think the answer is privatize everything, privatize education, privatize research, it's not enough, it's not coordinated, and it's not the system that has made us the envy of the world. And that's what I'm so disturbed about. Yes, we need private philanthropy, but we need this coordinated effort to drive discovery and to get the healthcare results and the economic results to do that.
Prasad, who is the top regulator in vaccines, whose email was leaked. By the way, the email is amazing. It's like five single space pages. Like, go in and read it. It's like, wow, you really didn't think this was going to get out there? I was surprised
maybe
by that.
He
but
did.
He said, if you disagree, resign. And I think that's an incredibly negative perspective. And I think it permeates the entire Trump administration. I think a good leader, an effective leader, wants people under them who disagree. I like working with people who are going to call me out, who are going to make me look at things that I haven't looked at before, who are going to present a different perspective. We're losing that across the federal government. And that's been one of our strengths, is having a variety of opinions and expertise where we can be sort of that, you know, check and balance within these agencies. And we're losing that. It's a terrible loss.
And peer-reviewed research is the fundamentals, right, of how research works and why you're so effective. And once you have the discovery, you need to do the testing. And that's where FDA comes in to see if a drug should come to market, right? If it's safe enough, or what are all the implications? Or if a drug comes to market and then there are unintended consequences, how do you pull it back? How do you put the warnings? FDA black box warning that says, okay, this does have value, but it also has negative consequences. What if you don't have the people anymore to do that? Where's the trust going to be in our system?
And we haven't seen the real impacts of that. I mean, I think we know this dismantling is happening, but we haven't seen the lives lost yet that are going to be lost because of all these changes. It's coming.
Well, on the USAID side, we've seen the lives lost. You know, in the healthcare, in the cuts in AIDS funding and such. Nick Kristof, read him, follow him. He has tracked, and there's enormous numbers of lives lost already because of the medicines that haven't, you know, because of the dismantling of USAID funding, both food security and medicine, without any advance notice, that has cost lives.
Mark, last couple minutes are yours.
Yeah, I actually think we are seeing the loss of life, not only in Africa, but, you know, the Weather Service, when those tornadoes ripped through Kentucky, could barely bring themselves to bring out real-time warnings. And we're seeing people thrown off of trials or no longer have access to medication. But I agree with the following. This is only the tip of that iceberg.
Yes.
We're going to pay a long-term cost, particularly if you think of the inherent nature of research and development.
And look at the measles cases. And now families are afraid of, you know, they don't know what to do, what direction to turn in, what's true, what's not true. You know, that's loss of life.
And then back to Lee Zeldin. I mean, the cost long term of diminishing some of the protections that the EPA has put in place. The long term cost of that is really hard to measure, but it's significant and it's real. My hope is that, you know, as soon as we can, we start to restore the damage that's been done, and we do it in a very considered way.
And you think about, this is happening at the same time. They're just unimaginable cuts in housing, more than 50%. What about the people who are going to be living out on the streets? I mean, I remember, I've talked about this before, when I was in Washington in the early 80s, Reagan became president, cut all these funds. Homelessness increased dramatically. People were freezing to death on the streets.
I agree.
We're okay, at the we beginning. Have to say something happy before
we're
go.
We're at the beginning of a difficult period for the American people, and hopefully we're strong enough to rebuild and come together with some unified.
But voting has mattered, and we'll see how, if the Republicans in the next few weeks, 24 million people are going to lose their health care unless they vote to fix this ACA problem. Let's start with that, folks, and see how they respond. Right now it looks like they won't, but they could. That will save lives.
Your panel this morning has been Teresa Bourgeois, March Gallagher, and Mark Whitman. I'm Sarah LaDuc, in for Joe Donahue. The panel will be posted on our website in a bit, should you care to listen if you missed part of it or listen again. That's WAMC.org, where you can also always make a safe and secure donation to your public media outlet. Thank you for being here today, everybody. I'm
Sarah
LaDuc.
Thank you, Sarah. You're awesome.
Thanks, Teresa. And you're listening to The Roundtable.